From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. For the past 5 years and counting, a higher court ruling has largely shaped how the West can respond to homeless encampments. You may have heard the case, Martin versus Boise, but regardless, several cities and counties across Western states, as well as our own governor, have blamed the Ninth Circuit court ruling, or at least its interpretation, as being a major barrier to reducing the number of people who are unhoused, because it comes with a stipulation. The people sleeping outside can only be cleared from public areas as long as there is adequate shelter space to offer. And in many places, including here in Sacramento, shelter capacity is a small fraction when compared to the number of people experiencing homelessness on any given night. But that decision on encampment sweeps may have an expiration date because the Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case challenging the 2018 lower court ruling. Joining us now is Marisa Kendall, who reports on homelessness for the nonprofit newsroom CalMatters, a content-sharing partner with public media stations across the state. Marisa, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the case that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear. What is it trying to do, and where did it originate from?
Yeah, it originated in Grants Pass in Southern Oregon. And basically, the city came to the court. They wanted more freedom to be able to clear homeless encampments in their city. And now it's going to have implications that are going to go much beyond Oregon, as it calls into question the premise of the Martin v. Boise case.
Okay, so it wants, you know, more leeway to clear encampments. What is their argument for wanting that?
Yeah, so they, as well as cities around the state, basically are saying that the ruling ties their hands too strictly. They're saying that this court ruling prevents them from being able to clear encampments that are dangerous, maybe unsanitary, unhealthy, both for the people living in those encampments and for the housed neighbors in the vicinity.
And this all stems from, you know, 5 years ago, 2018, the case of Martin versus Boise. You know, we have a good amount of time to see how this ruling has impacted Western states. Can you remind us, you know, how this shapes how cities and counties can really deal with encampments?
Yeah, so the gist is basically the court says that cities and counties cannot ticket, arrest, or otherwise punish people who are homeless for sleeping on public property if they have no other option. So cities have largely interpreted this to mean if they're going to clear a homeless encampment, they need to first make sure that there's enough shelter beds to offer every person who's going to be displaced. And like you said, that's a really can be a tough ask when we don't have enough shelter beds. And you've seen homeless activists and homeless and people living in homeless encampments sue as various cities have tried to sweep their camps. And in many cases, they've won and been awarded at least temporary restrictions on what the city's allowed to do in terms of clearing their camp.
So this ruling applies to California as well as 8 other Western states. Was this ruling back in 2018, was it unique or unusual in how it restricted clearing encampments?
Yeah, the ruling really went a step farther than we had seen in the past. So now you really see this ruling as what sets the limits in terms of what cities and counties are able to do. And after this ruling, you really did see cities and counties change their enforcement. And you really saw the cities had to roll back any prior, you know, blanket bans on camping that they had, and they really had to be more careful with their enforcement.
And this is also coupled with the pandemic, because in 2020, when obviously the state shut down, there was also, you know, public health, you know, the risk of public health that encampments couldn't be cleared for not only this court ruling, but also for public health reasons as well.
Exactly. And as a result of that, you saw encampments just become bigger and bigger and more entrenched. Whereas before, you might have a handful of tents, and every couple months, the city comes and tells everyone, move along, and the tents go somewhere else. Now you had encampments that were allowed to remain for several years, and people were building, you know, shacks out of pallets and plywood and corrugated metal, and they really became much more entrenched, almost little shanty towns. And then there became a big backlash against these larger encampments from neighbors.
As we know, when it comes to court rulings, they're not really black and white. There's a lot of room for interpretation. You know, where is there some gray area or lack of definition when it comes to this 2018 ruling?
Yeah, so one thing that some cities have been trying to take advantage of as a possible loophole is, the court does not allow cities to have a blanket ban on homeless encampments unless they have enough shelter for everyone. But some cities are getting around that by banning encampments in very specific areas. So they're banning encampments near schools or near public infrastructure, or banning camps that block both sides of a sidewalk, things like that. Another thing that is up for debate is whether cities can enforce a camping ban if they have offered people in that encampment shelter and they've refused, right? And then another question is what constitutes adequate shelter? If a city wants to clear a camp and they offer someone a shelter bed, what does that bed have to be? Can it be a bed in a congregate facility where it's one cot with, 100 other people in a big room? Or is it a tiny home? Or is it a motel room? Do they have to offer them multiple options because maybe the unhoused person can't take one of the options? So there's a lot of questions in the air.
And that happened in Chico in 2021, right?
Yeah, the court there basically said Chico was trying to send folks out of encampments and into basically a sanctioned encampment that was on a piece of asphalt where people would be living in tents. And a judge said, no, that does not count. That does not count as shelter and does not allow you to clear this encampment.
You know, in the years since, we have heard the argument that this ruling can be a barrier. You know, even the governor has talked about that as well. But has it been challenged before to this degree now that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear this case? Is Grants Pass the first to try and get this overturned or reversed?
Yeah, this is the first time that the Supreme Court has said we're going to take a crack at this. So this is really big news for cities and for folks who work with homeless communities.
Why do you think the Supreme Court agreed to hear this challenge now? I mean, is there something about the makeup of the court that potentially led to this?
Well, there's a lot of political pressure right now to address this. When you have, everyone from even the governor, Gavin Newsom, expressing, weighing in on this and pressuring the court to take this. Also, just homelessness has gotten so bad. It's on the top of everyone's agenda. Encampments have, proliferated. Unsheltered homelessness is soaring. I think there's a general sense that we need to do something. And local politicians are saying, this court case is tying our hands and preventing us from combating homelessness in our cities. I think there was just a lot of pressure to act.
Given that California is home to the largest unhoused population in the country, it's in the six figures. If this actually moves forward, the Supreme Court agrees with the case and grants pass, jurisdictions and states now have more leeway. What are the biggest changes that could take place?
Yeah, and that's an interesting question because especially in liberal cities, in Sacramento and in the Bay Area, I don't think the cities are going to just start removing encampments left and right willy-nilly and not offering anyone shelter. That is something we had done in the past, and it has been proven that that doesn't work. That if you just if you move people from encampment to encampment without bringing them indoors, that doesn't solve your city's homelessness problem. And local politicians don't want to be seen as cruelly just shuttling homeless people around without helping them. So I think you're still going to see in cities like Sacramento, city officials doing a lot of outreach to people in encampments, trying to get them into shelter, offering them shelter beds, trying to get them housed, and then clearing encampments that they think pose problems. But this will give, if this case does fall, it would give cities a lot more leeway to maybe target problem encampments and quickly clear them without court intervention.
When you talk to homeless advocates or people who are opposed to changing Martin versus Boise, are they concerned that this is headed up to the Supreme Court?
They are. They're very concerned. They think it's really cruel and inhumane to clear an encampment without offering people shelter. Every time you clear an encampment, you displace everyone living there, which can be really traumatic for the people living there who already have very little. Also, every time a camp is cleared, the people living there often lose a lot of their belongings. A lot of what they own is trashed, is lost. And every time a camp is cleared and people are displaced, they're scattered, and sometimes their caseworkers lose track of them. So the people who are tasked with helping them find housing, helping them with food and medical needs, sometimes lose them. A lot of these folks don't have a cell phone or have nowhere to charge it, so it's really hard to keep track of them.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CalMatters reporter Marisa Kendall about a case out of Oregon that will go before the Supreme Court and has the chance of overturning existing precedent for how Western cities and states can clear homeless encampments. Here in Sacramento, almost 2 years ago, voters in the city passed Measure O, and this was back in 2022. And that made homeless encampments on public property somewhat illegal under certain circumstances. It gets kind of complicated, but the stipulation was also that it required more shelter spaces. So it's kind of similar. Have other cities taken similar steps in restricting camping for unhoused people or just restricting them from just sleeping on the streets? Or is Sacramento alone in this?
No, we've actually seen a big increase in recent years in cities doing that, which I think was partly a backlash to what we had just talked about encampments becoming much larger during COVID. So we've seen everywhere from Oakland has an encampment policy. We've seen them in San Diego and Santa Cruz. We've seen a lot of cities try to crack down. And even some like San Jose are thinking about trying to impose more specific restrictions on where people can and can't camp.
As cities, counties, local jurisdictions try to do this, have courts stepped in and challenged or stopped these measures?
They have. There's been several cases where cities have been barred from clearing specific encampments, sometimes just temporarily until they can prove they have enough shelter. That's happened in Oakland and Berkeley and Emeryville. Very recently in San Francisco, a ban was upheld preventing the city from clearing encampments. The court says, you say you're offering shelter beds, but the shelters are full, so you are not doing enough to help get these people inside.
Have California officials, local, statewide, have they joined in on this case that's heading to the Supreme Court, in messaging or statements?
Gavin Newsom's definitely the most prominent figure to weigh in on this, and he's very much in favor. He was very much in favor of the Supreme Court taking this on. He has not been shy in saying that Martin v. Boise is hampering not only the hands of city officials, but also Caltrans from clearing encampments on state right away. And he not only was he hoping that this would be changed, but he was also asking for more clarity in terms of just giving more guidance as to what was prohibited and what was allowed under this rule. He accused some courts of taking the Martin v. Boise ruling too far.
And he included a statement, right, as part of this court filing.
He did, yeah. You can submit amicus briefs, basically friend of the court briefs, to that the court will consider when it is determining whether to weigh in on a case.
Hypothetically, if this actually moves forward and now states have more leeway, do you think it might actually remove the incentive for cities and counties to build more shelter space?
It could. I mean, you would hope that it would not, because obviously there's still such a huge problem and we need so many more shelter beds. But this could remove the added incentive where, counties and cities were saying, okay, we have to build X number of shelter beds because if we don't, we cannot enforce our camping bans. We can't remove encampments. That incentive could go away. You'd like to think cities still will be building those shelter beds because folks need to get inside, but I suppose we'll see.
Yeah, it could be incentive or pressure that the pressure goes away. Finally, when could this be heard by the Supreme Court? Any idea?
I think we're still waiting on a date to be set on that, but I think everyone will be really interested in that. A lot of people are watching to see what happens here.
Marisa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Marisa Kendall is CalMatters homelessness reporter, and we've been talking about a new case that will go in front of the Supreme Court, which has the potential to change how California sweeps homeless encampments. Up next, California's crime rate has dominated news headlines, but when you look at the data, gauging an increase or whether there's one at all largely depends on where and when you look. We'll learn about the complexities within crime data. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Schlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Crime in California. We have all seen videos and heard stories of retail thefts all over the state. Mom and pop shops, grocery stores, malls targeted by thieves rushing in and stealing everything they can get their hands on. Perhaps stores in your area have started to lock up merchandise. Last week, Assemblyman Rick Chavez-Zeber, who chairs the Assembly's Select Committee on Retail Theft, called the situation, quote, a crisis becoming equal to the issue of unhoused individuals in California. But the data tells a more complicated story. For example, here in Sacramento, shoplifting is down. So while crime makes a lot of headlines and is certainly a politically hot potato, we want to take the extra time to examine what this data actually shows, which with context could help lead to real solutions. We welcome Magnus Lofstrom. He is the Policy Director of Criminal Justice and a Senior Fellow at the nonprofit Public Policy Institute of California, or PPIC. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So let's start with the big picture, because there's a lot of data out there, a lot of headlines, and that can open itself up to being talked about with like a wide brushstroke that is lacking in specifics. What do you want us to keep in mind before we dive into the PPC's findings about crime, specifically retail theft and robberies in California?
Well, I think, you know, I really appreciate that. We want to think about the complexity of crime and crime data. And what kind of perspective to take. So I think the first thing to do is actually start off with like a long-term historical perspective. Where are violent crime rates and property crime rates today, you know, compared to when they peaked in the 80s and 90s? And so that's the good news. They're so much lower than they were back in the 80s and 90s. They're less than half of what they were at that particular point in time. So that's good news. But we are also seeing some increases in the recent years in some types of crime. And for some types of crime, it is very localized, and we see it in just certain areas. But broadly, we saw a drop in homicides in 2022. That's the most recent year we have data for, of about 6%. But homicides still remains higher, by about 34% higher than they were before the pandemic. And we also have seen aggravated assaults tick up over the last few years. So they are about 25% higher than they were before the pandemic. And I think that the other one that kind of stands out is auto theft. It's been ticking up in the last few years as well, and it's up by about 32%. So those are some of the things that stand out from that broad perspective. Mm.
And you also look at gun violence as well. I mean, what data do you have that shows how gun violence compares, you know, post-pandemic, or we're still in a pandemic, but to pre-pandemic, like 2019.
Yeah, no, absolutely. When we look at, especially, you know, obviously we're talking about violent crime here. And what we're seeing is that those increases that I mentioned in homicides and aggravated assaults, those are primarily driven by increases in gun-related incidents. And even if we look at robberies, robberies are actually lower today than they were before the pandemic. But robberies that involve guns, they are up by about 12% compared to before the pandemic. So guns, when it comes to violent crime, are, you know, increasingly playing a larger role.
Hmm. When it comes to where this is happening, I mean, is it generally widespread across the state, or are there specifically parts of California that are truly experiencing more crime, and while others perhaps are maybe have fared better?
Yeah, it's definitely the case. If we're talking about violent crime, for example, the biggest increases we've seen are really in the Central Valley, and also in Alameda County, for example. Those are examples of where we've seen notable increases, and less so in some of the coastal Southern California areas. So again, you know, even though there are broader increases in violent crime over the last few years here in California, there are some differences there, and you see the biggest increases in the Central Valley and Alameda County in particular.
Do you have an understanding as to why, you know, some areas are higher than others and others are faring better?
You know, I really wish we had a good answer to that. And part of the problem is that when you look at what's happened over these last few years, you know, I'm making comparison to how things were before the pandemic, and the pandemic brought so many changes. First, there were challenges, you know, for the criminal justice systems to prevent the spread of COVID, led to changes, drawdowns in prison and jails, population arrests, bookings. Courts had, you know, their own challenges as well. Increased economic and health uncertainty. We had the reactions to, the violent protests in reaction to the murder of George Floyd, presented challenges to law enforcement. And then also we had decreases in the number of police, so challenges in recruitment and retention. You know, it's a long list of plausible contributors to these changes. But given that there's so many changes happening at once, it's really difficult to point at, yeah, here's the one that's behind this, some of the troubling increases.
Yeah, and the PPIC, I mean, you have a tremendous amount of data, and the point of that is to shape policy. You recently testified at the state capitol on the Assembly Select Committee on Retail Theft, and this was back in December, and you shared data regarding retail thefts and robberies in the state. What was the big message that you wanted to get across to lawmakers?
I think that there are, first of all, there are challenges with the data that are available, in that there are some limitations, especially when we talk about retail theft. You know, we're talking about shoplifting, for example, and when we're talking about shoplifting, these lower value incidents, it's very likly that there's a, you know, a notable degree of underreporting, meaning that, you know, retailers aren't reporting all of these incidents. And there might be changes in this reporting. So, you know, that's one of the challenge, and that might contribute to why we're seeing, you know, different views of the problem of retail theft. But the other part is coming back to what you were mentioning, Vicky, is that we have these big geographic differences. We are seeing, if we're looking at shoplifting, for example, the first thing is we saw a big jump in 2022 of 29%. But to put that in perspective, we're still 8% below what we were before the pandemic. But so that doesn't really hint at the, you know, shoplifting being a problem. But even when we look at shoplifting, which probably captures primarily lower value theft incidents here in California, we see some areas where there are notable increases in the Bay Area in particular. San Mateo jumped by over 50%. We saw over 20% increase in San Francisco over that same period of time. So the Bay Area has seen increases in the lower value retail theft incidents. if we look at higher value retail theft incidents, now we'll go to the crime data and we'll look at commercial burglaries. And here we see a broader increase in commercial burglaries in California. It's up by about 16% statewide since 2019. It is primarily an urban problem. And when we looked at the 15 largest counties, we saw that it was up in 14 of those. So it depends on kind of like what type of incidents we're looking at, and it depends on where we are. And I think that contributes to these kind of difficulties in assessing how big of a problem is this or not. So the fact that the data has its limitation and geographic variations complicates things.
Yeah, when going through your data, I mean, I had to go through it very slowly because are we talking about shoplifting, which has a $950 threshold? Are we talking about commercial burglaries, which are over $950? Or are we talking about commercial robberies, which is a use of force? You know, there's a threatening aspect to it. And that is considered, can be considered a violent crime. Given that the state has been aware of this problem before the pandemic, Governor Newsom, I believe in his first year as governor, created an organized task force on retail theft. This was back in 2019. I would imagine when you testify, they're using your data. How has this data over the years, even before the pandemic, because it was already recognized as a problem, been useful towards shaping real solutions?
Well, that's a real challenge here is that when we're looking at these numbers that I just shared with you, we don't know to what extent this is driven by organized retail theft. There's nowhere in the data that it actually identifies those kind of incidents. And, and that's another real challenge in all of this is that we don't know what is the driving force behind the increases that we've seen in some areas. And kind of when we think about it, what would be the most effective policy solutions are going to be very different if it is indeed organized retail theft, as opposed to situations where people are acting out of economic desperation. And so that's kind of the challenge. We really don't know at this point. We don't know to what extent it's driven by organized retail theft incidents.
Yeah, and it also depends on, you know, who is the source, who is giving this information. I mean, there are, lobbying groups and the Retail Association, understandably they have a vested interest. And so they're going to, share their perspective, but that's a perspective, right? There's a difference between accuracy and truth. When you actually, listen or watch reporting or news headlines about, burglaries and smash and grabs, you can see it easily on social media, especially with surveillance video and cell phones now. What do you want people to keep in mind?
Well, I think these are the kind of incidents that grab the headlines. It gets our attention. But first of all, I think it's important to keep in mind it's not unique to California, especially when we're talking about these smash and grabs. That is nothing that is unique to California. The other part is that, we don't know to what extent what the real frequency of these incidents are, because they just simply tend to get our attention probably in a large number of when these incidents mm-hmm. happen. So they're overrepresented in media compared to, or in social media for that matter, compared to the kind of role that they play in the trends mm-hmm. that I'm sharing with you.
You said on multiple occasions, the data can be challenging to get. What would make your job as a fellow, whose world is research, what would make it easier?
Well, the first thing would be to have more complete information on each of the incidents. And I think that the only way that we can get that is really to have retailers help out and essentially help out collecting more complete information where we know of all or the majority of the incidents that are taking place. Because what we can do then is we can benchmark that against what the crime data tells us as well. That's kind of the first thing. The other part is to kind of having more information about each of the incidents and what are the consequences and what are the responses by law enforcement when there is a reported incident? Are there arrests? Are these cases passed on to prosecutors? And what are the decisions that the prosecutors make, and what happens eventually in terms of disposition? Is there a conviction or not? That's the kind of information I think we really need to have in order to identify what are the effective policy solutions to this challenge that is presented to retailers.
And I know the data that we're talking about stems from 2022 compared to like 2019. 2022 is the most recent data you have that has the entire year. But just a couple months ago, we had, for an example, we had the city of Sacramento on, and they were celebrating a significant reduction in violent crime in the city from the same time period in 2023. It wasn't the entire year. It was like from January to the end of September compared to 2022. Anecdotally, or just on the surface level, as you're starting to look into data from last year, do you think we may be trending in a better direction when it comes to violent crime?
I think when it comes to violent crime, there are some, you know, encouraging signs out there. There are some FBI data available for the first half of 2023, and it's pointing towards, you know, decreases in violent crime in 2023 compared to 2022. You know, that does not include many of California cities, so, you know, it's hard then to tell what exactly what it would look like in California. But it was nice to see that there were some encouraging signs in terms of violent crime from those data as well.
What are you interested in learning in 2024?
Oh, wow. Well, I think, you know, there are, I think it's following up. It's we have seen some increases in some crime. It's really trying to figure out what's behind some of these increases. And certainly retail theft has gotten a lot of the attention recently. And the question is really, you know, what is behind it? What are some of the contributing factors? So I'm looking at possibly, you know, understanding that a little bit better, you know, and particularly focusing in on what are the responses to reported incidents to see how that might translate to the broader trends as well. You know, I'm hoping that we can reverse some of these trends. You know, the auto theft trend hopefully will, you know, start to come down as well. So I'm looking forward to just seeing, you know, more of these data and just, you know, fingers crossed that what we're going to see in you know, these upcoming data releases will be good news for us.
Magnus, as always, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Magnus Lofstrom is the Policy Director of Criminal Justice and a Senior Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, or PPIC. Still ahead, he has captivated NPR's Tiny Desk by uprooting centuries-old Black American folk songs and giving them new life. Jake Blunt joins us ahead of his performance at the Sophia. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. When I say folk music or Americana, a certain song style may pop into your head, but our next guest is dismantling how we have long experienced these genres in the mainstream by going deep into the past, uprooting what we think we know, and giving this foundational creative expression new life. Jake Blunt is an Afrofuturist folk musician and a scholar of traditional Black American folk music who resurrects and rearranges centuries-old work with a modern approach. The best way to understand his work is to experience it. Jake has performed at Carnegie Hall, the Library of Congress, and NPR's Tiny Desk last year, and this week he'll be performing at the Sophia in Sacramento Thursday night. Jake Blunt joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
When I was listening to your music yesterday, it brought the biggest smile to my face. I loved it. I'm curious, what came first for you? Because there's a lot of research that is behind your music and your artistry. What came first, the passion for music as a creative outlet or researching the past?
The research came first for me, actually. I'd been playing music for a long time, but not this type of music. I grew up as a little rocker kid with an electric guitar and wound up having kind of a fortunate chance encounter with a banjo player back home in Washington, D.C., where I'm from, who told me a little bit about the history of the instrument, that it had been invented by enslaved Africans here in the Americas. And that prompted me to want to learn more about it. And through doing that research and meeting the community associated with that instrument and the music attached to it, I kind of just fell in love with it and started playing all the time.
Given that your hometown is D.C., you know, what significance did growing up in our nation's capital have on you?
Oh, a lot. I mean, my parents are both political journalists. So it was a constant immersion in controversy and the discourse of the day, for better or for worse. But I'm grateful for it, as weird as it was in retrospect, and as weird as it seems every time I go back now that I live somewhere else, I'm grateful to have grown up there.
I want to get to Afrofuturistic music. I mean, how did you land on that as a form of expression?
Well, I think it felt logical to me in some ways, you know, Afrofuturism being this kind of expression of alternative versions of the future, that come out in Black literature, in Black art, in Black music, going back centuries now, before the term Afrofuturism was ever coined. I mean, there are scholars like Isaiah Lavender III who have done all this research on, you know, Frederick Douglass and Harriet Jacobs. How many of these old authors that we've all read in school might fall under that banner? And I think the same thing applies to music, that the music that I was studying, even before I started making explicitly Afrofuturist work, was Afrofuturist, right? These are technologies that were created to serve specific purposes, whether they're work songs that were meant to regulate the pace of labor and coordinate people's actions in a field or labor setting to keep people from getting hurt, or whether they're spirituals that were meant to pass on a coded meaning about how and when you might want to travel to escape slavery in some cases, or just to go steal some food so your family could eat in other cases. And I also think that there's a level of science fiction involved when you go back and learn all that old material, because, you know, you're kind of fabricating this old thing. Even when you go back into the older archives in the way that I sometimes do, in the way many of my peers do, with the mentality of, I'm going to learn this song, I'm going to bring the essence of this song to the now. The people back then couldn't do that, right? And especially when you're working with recorded music, with these field recordings that folklorists went out and made on acetate discs or wax cylinders, depending on the era in question. You have to also grapple with the fact that you're using a technology that is not native to the music, that you're not learning from a person, you're learning from a copy of this person, a facsimile of them that's been passed through several different forms of media and changed a little bit in each one of those transductions along the way. There's a lot of making things up, even when you take traditional music at face value and just try to reenact it. When you hear that banjo tune and try to play it exactly the same way on your banjo, you're making stuff up. And I decided I wanted to just embrace that and go a little further with it and talk about some things that I think we need to be talking about right now that people back in the day didn't have the scientific knowledge to discuss.
Yeah, and I think to really capture that, I listened to your NPR Tiny Desk performance. It was almost a year ago. It was January of last year. It wasn't just you. I mean, it was eight other musicians. I mean, you had vocalists, you had a rapper, a fiddle player, drums, guitar, banjo, tambourine, bass. I mean, there was a whole party there. How was that experience for you?
It was difficult. I mean, it was a very good time. It wasn't difficult interpersonally or emotionally. But, you know, I am a one man show over here for the most part. I got a great booking agent, but nobody to help me put together things like that. So it was a big logistical lift getting everybody in place, getting rehearsals done, making sure everybody knew what they were doing. And of course, it's the tiny desk, right? That's like the one of the biggest things that's ever going to happen in your career. So it was a high pressure situation. It was at the very beginning of the tour. And the next two nights, I fell asleep on couches backstage during intermission because I was so exhausted. So it was a heavy lift, but I'm really glad that we made it. I'm really proud of that performance, and I'm really happy that I got to bring so much of my wonderful music community onto that, well, not a stage, but, you know, behind that desk with me.
Yeah. Well, it was well worth all that effort and all that stress and all that energy that you exerted. We're going to listen to excerpts from the Tiny Desk from last year. The first song is Man Was Burning.
People in the land of Georgia, little they cared about God. When the news got in the land that the man was burning on a log, that man was counting his money. Yeah, he was grinning mighty broad. He held a greenback dollar aloft, said, "This money gonna make me a god." I'll tell you about the man was burning.
Jake, what is the history of this song?
So this is a song called The Man Was Burning, and I learned it from a recording of a guy named Joe Lee from State Penitentiary, Virginia. And it's a special one for me because my family is from a town called Smithfield in Tidewater, Virginia, which if anybody listening has ever had Smithfield ham or any Smithfield pork products, that's what we do there. Most of the members of my family worked in that meatpacking plant at one time or another, up until my generation. And it's rare sometimes to find music from that part of the world. A lot of the folkloric collection that went on was farther west in the Piedmont and in the mountains. So it was cool to find something that was relatively close. In state penitentiaries up toward Richmond, it is in the Piedmont, but it was still nearby. And I'd never heard it before, as far as I know, other than Joe Lee and one other person who I guess was recorded in Danville, Virginia, singing a different version of the song. I think I'm the only modern recording of that. And it was a really cool thing. I just heard the song and decided to mess around with it and wound up writing all the parts and playing everything except the bass just in my apartment over the course of like 3 days, and the song was done in probably a week. And it's still my top streamed song. Got picked as one of the best blues songs of 2022 by Spotify. So I'm really proud of how that came together, and definitely felt like catching some lightning in a bottle.
What do you think that means, that people have become so receptive, not only to this song, The Man Was Burning, but to overall your work and why you're doing what you're doing?
I think people have been ready for it, honestly. And this is the thing, right? So that song, The Man Was Burning, like I said, I don't think any other modern artists have recorded it. I don't know anyone other than me and my band that knows it. Except, you know, we went over to play this big, big festival in Denmark that's like a pop festival. Like the headliners were Lil Nas X, Lizzo, and Kendrick Lamar. And this audience of like 6 foot tall blonde people were like singing every word to that song. I guess it had been put on some playlist or whatever, and they loved it. And I just think that, you know, we have this pattern with roots music in the US And probably more broadly, that every 10 or so years, there's this big boom. And we can think of like, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? As one of the things that incited one of those booms. Or that weird early 2010s Americana stomp clap hey boom that we had back when I was in high school. But I think that fresh perspectives on this material are often appreciated. And I also think that there's a bit of a breath of fresh air because so much of the music industry these days, partially just due to people's prejudices and preconceived notions about what it means to be a musician, and partially because of our very broken intellectual property law system in this country, privileges creating just original music. And I think that original music has a valuable place in creation and in society. I also think that it misses something that the older traditional stuff has, and probably vice versa, right? I think both sides are needed. But I think that hearing this old stuff that by design has to speak across time and across difference because it's been passed through so many hands on its way down to us, and hearing it recontextualized to speak to us now instead of presented as this kind of fossilized thing out of a museum or an archive, I think it's exciting to people. I think people want to feel attached to that old stuff and sometimes don't know how to get there because that old stuff isn't being reformatted in a way that speaks to them. And I'm hopeful every day that I may be learning to envision what these traditions might have sounded like if they had been allowed to grow organically alongside all of the other musical innovation that was taking place in the communities that spawned them. Where would old-time string band music be today if Black people had still been playing that while they were inventing disco, right? It's a really interesting thought experiment. And I think that idea of restoring something to the music that has been lost because it's been historicized, because people have resisted changing it, and maybe warped or distorted it as a result, ironically enough. I think people are ready for that.
Well, I want to listen to one of your oldest bits of music. You had said this in Tiny Dust that it is from 1687, so over 400 years ago, and it's called The Downward Road.
Thought they would do mighty well, but when they come to find out, they done meet up a bit in hell. Lord, the downward road is crowded. Lord, believe it so. Crowded. Lord, believe it so.
Gather round. Lo, I've seen what the trickster hid. Hear the sound of a king trying to get it. The water rising, surrounding everybody that's in it. And Lil Silas wanna come home. All he got is the cot that he drum on. Whole family pole, he was taught not to run from it when you come from it. But the king ain't never alone. A feeling Silas thought that he never would know. The water rose, he a old soul. Said his upbringing sold him it all. It's nothing he don't know. The water rose, but he homegrown. He feel like he seen everything. He been outside like an evergreen. And as for Silas, he just want a chance. The king got the means to, but he don't wanna ask. Silas got older and took over, the same king in his story still running from his past.
Look at our old grasping rulers, thought they would do mighty well.
And that is Demeanor, Justin Harrington on rap vocals. Jake, we only have like a minute left, but people have really, I mean, myself included, got just a wonderful sense of what people will experience on Thursday when you're here in Sacramento at the Sophia. What do you want people to take away? How do you want them to leave Thursday night?
I think that right now, what I would like to have people take away from the show is the mindfulness of the fact that throughout history, people have faced dark futures like the one we are currently staring down, and that these songs were created as a way to help people envision a future that was different and to help people envision solutions and work toward those solutions, even when the powers that be resisted them. And I would hope that people would leave my show feeling rejuvenated and reinvigorated and feeling the urgency of finding a solution to climate change, of finding a solution to institutionalized racism, and of creating a ceasefire.
Jake, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jake Blunt is an Afrofuturist folk musician who is a scholar of Black American folk and rearranges work from the past to highlight the ways African Americans have shaped and defined roots music and Americana. Jake will be performing here in Sacramento in downtown at the Sophia Thursday night, January 18th at 7 p.m. And that is it for Insight today, live at noon with a rebroadcast at 7 p.m. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer and audio engineer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.